So I actually screwed myself out of a few dozen properties back then because I was so determined, even in the middle of a 60% price decline from peak, not to overpay. Right? So the buyer-seller gap is ever present. It never goes away. It's there at peak. It's there in the middle. It's there in the trough. It's there in the middle of a depression. It's always there.
Let's get ready to scale. Hey guys, welcome to yet another episode of Ready to Scale. I'm Jeanette Robinson. Joining me today is Neil Bawa. He may not really require much of an introduction, but nonetheless, if you're not familiar with Neil, he is the CEO at Grow Capitus Investments and Multifamily University. He sources, negotiates, acquires commercial properties across the US. He has a very large portfolio, and it's been exciting to watch him growing it out over the years, that has now exceeded $1 billion as far as assets under management with both multifamily and student housing properties. He's a nationally recognized speaker at many multifamily events, IRA events, and meetups across the country. And he also is the self-proclaimed mad scientist of multifamily and definitely what I would call a data nerd, which I mean that in the highest of respect because I love data. So Neil, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me back. It's always great to be on Ready to Scale, especially given the turbulent and interesting times we live in today.
You know, very much so. We've taken a new approach this season at having what we're calling just candidly real talk. So we're getting real about some of the conversations, you know, that people are having behind the scenes when it comes to multifamily investing. And I'm, you know, I think that today's topic is going to fit in perfectly with those real talks. And so what we're talking about is you know, emotions. There's a lot of emotions in the market right now. And understandably, people are human. We're not robots. And when we are looking at our investments, when we're seeing the challenges in the economy, when we're looking at the interest rates, when we're looking at cash flow getting devoured by, you know, huge demands on debt burdens, and when we're seeing operators starting to bow out of the game, there's a lot of things that people are seeing and feeling that make it kind of scary. You know, it really does. I know I've talked to some investors that are just pulling out altogether and will continue to do so for however long they decide to do so. And I know that, you know, I've spoken with other investors that think it's fantastic and they're really bullish. They think there's going to be a bunch of opportunity, but not yet. They're waiting for it. So they're also not moving. So it's just really interesting, you know, kind of the variety of feelings that people have. What are some of your thoughts or some of your insights into what you're seeing?
Well, I think that times like this are fascinating because they lay bare the truth. And that the truth that I believe is that everyone's a speculator. You know, most investors, they chase either over bullish trends or they chase bad news and they speculate and they run away from profit because investment is a different concept than speculation. You know, you have these four different phases of emotional investing or speculation, right? So you've got the phase one, which is, I'm pleased with my investment. You know, that's the phase of optimism or enthusiasm or exuberance, euphoria even, right? And then you get into phase two and you sense that there's some sort of downturn coming. And then you're like, well, this is a temporary downturn. I'm in it for the long run. And that's basically denial or fear or despair. That's the phase that you're in. And then you get into the third phase, and that is, you know, the market's not going in my favor, right? It's not in my favor. And that favor, that phase we call, you know, it's typically panic or capitulation. It's discouragement. It's gloom, right? And then is phase four. And that phase four is, you know, I'm glad I stayed invested, right? That, so that point you get some relief or you're moving back towards optimism. And these are the four phases of emotional investing that basically every investor goes through. The question is, you know, how well do you do with each of these phases? What is your emotional resilience? You know, are you really an investor or are you a speculator? Let me give you an example, right? So I think this will really take it home. Every investor at every cocktail party is always quoting Warren Buffett because Warren Buffett is the absolute king of value-based investing and an absolute king of not making bad decisions at distressed times. And there's been so many examples, and I have some examples that I can give you today of how Warren Buffett has made money in distressed times. So everyone quotes him, but how many people actually follow what he's saying? Because I find that the number is very small. Everyone wants to have a time machine that takes you back to 2009. Well, I can tell you, I was buying a property in 2009 every month. And I was peeing in my pants as I was doing it because everyone was telling me that I was wrong. My own family prevented me from going to parties because they thought that I would infect the other, kids in the family with my stupid thoughts about this being the best time to invest in real estate. Well, I'm a data scientist. The numbers were ridiculously in my favor. And so I would go to parties, and the first thing I wanted to talk about was how this is the most amazing time to buy real estate. And so I was prevented from going to my own family events. And so when that happens, when everyone around you, really smart people that you know and respect, are telling you that not only are you wrong, you're an idiot, right? And you're buying a property every month, it's an extremely difficult thing to be. So, be careful what you wish for, because 2009 was not some magical time when everything was right. 2009 was a time that was horrifying, right? Unemployment at 7%. Today we're at 3.5 or 3.8, depending upon the number that you want to look at. 5 million properties going back to the bank. Today we're talking about 2,500 multifamily properties at potential distress that have a DSCR below 1% out of God knows how many, right? But there were 5 million single family homes and way more than 2,500 multifamily properties that were at potential risk of going back to the bank. Numbers, economic fundamentals that were horrifying compared to today, where we have 3.8% unemployment. We've had 4.5% income growth in the last year, which is a terrific number, right? So we have all these terrific numbers, and everyone's terrified. Well, compare that with 2009, and all of those numbers would look absolutely atrocious compared to today. In fact, anybody who was in 2009 would love to be in 2023 because of the numbers that we have today. But the emotionally, investors are in the same place as 2009, right? And what's interesting is, even though they're emotionally in the same place as 2009, they're running away from profit. To them, this is actually a terrible time to buy. And it's such a horrifying, process that people, that vast majority of investors, out of 100, like 95 are going to think this way, maybe more. It's stunning because, despite the fact that for 10 years at every cocktail party, they quote Warren Buffett, be fearful when others are greedy, be greedy when others are fearful. But they're doing the exact same thing. 2009 and 2023 are actually very comparable years. You can compare those 2 years in many different ways and reach the same or similar conclusions. But nobody's reaching those conclusions, Jeanette, because they're still mentally a speculator, not an investor.
Very interesting. So there's a few things I want to kind of touch on. So first of all, when you broke down the four different types of emotion, I can't help but immediately correlate that to the different cycles that we have in the market in itself. So
That's
I
right.
assume that that's the two obviously probably mirror one another. Is that how you came to that?
They absolutely do. And in they very much mirror it, right? So four phases of the market, that the up phase, the plateau down, and then basically the starting to recover phase. Those four phases mirror the four phases of emotional investing, right? So optimism, denial, panic, and relief, and then return to optimism are the four phases. And what's interesting is this. So if I was sitting in front of Warren Buffett today, the first thing Warren would tell me is, I've been through all of these cycles and I've felt the same things. I've felt optimism, I've felt denial, panic, and dismay, and then return to optimism. So he feels it too because he's human, but he deals with it better than people. Right. So if you read Warren's books, and there's a bunch of very, very interesting books that I feel people should read, right? Irrational Exuberance by Robert Shiller is a brilliant book that really explains how investors are almost always doing the exact opposite of what they should be doing, right? And why does that happen, right? Warren Buffett himself has written books, but there's so many other books. In fact, I'm going to just name a few that I find are books that tell you, as an investor, you're investing millions of dollars. Many of, your investors, Jeanette, are investing millions of dollars. but they haven't taken the time to read like the top 10 books. Number one, Common Sense Investing. Number two, The Intelligence Investor. That's one by Benjamin Graham, right? There's the let's see, what else? Valuations and Value Investing. Those are two really good ones. There's another one called You Can Be a Stock Market Genius, and you're not investing in the stock market, you're investing in real estate. But this book is not about the stock market. It's about your mindset and the way that you think. So you can be a stock market genius. People are not investing in their education because they believe that just because what they did in the past worked, they don't need to do so anymore. Actually, 90% of your education should happen during a down cycle, right? Because that's when you can say to yourself, I need to learn more, right? Because the outcome isn't really good. And so people are not really taking that time to do that. If I was to talk to Warren Buffett, you know, Jeanette, what's the first thing he's going to say? I had the same cycles. I lost money. I had stocks that lost money. And what did I say to myself? The only way for me to recover from all of these losses is to invest at the bottom of the cycle, because that's
Exactly.
the only way that it works. So Warren's invested on the upturn,
That's why
right?
I was actually bringing it up, because I think that what's really important to understand is that it's a cycle, is it's intended to be a
It's
cycle.
intended to be a cycle, and it only works as a cycle, right? And
Right.
it's not any different for Warren Buffett as it is for us. In fact, if you were to read one of his books or just do a deep dive into his company, you'll notice that there's many years where Warren Buffett's company has lost a massive amount of money.
Oh, yeah.
But then 2 years later, they make a massive amount of money. Why? Because the same thing that led to them making money was the thing that led to them making money 2 years later, because they continued to buy during the down cycle. If a stock was worth, you know, if Warren Buffett is buying American Express at $70, and Amex is a great company, he's been a big investor in Amex. In fact, one of the Harvard you know, law school or Harvard a business school studies about how to invest is Warren Buffett's investment into American Express. So it's a very famous study. And you notice that he was buying, and then he lost money, and then he kept on buying. And as the stock came down, he continued to make purchases, right? The other thing that he did was, at no point did he say, I'll wait until the bottom of the market, because Warren and every other investor, if you talk to Benjamin Graham, the first thing that they say is, we cannot tell the bottom. No one can. If somebody figures out where the market bottoms, that person is a trillionaire. And given that there are no trillionaires on this planet, nobody has figured it out yet, right?
Yeah,
So
exactly. There's no
that's
ability
pretty
to tell
obvious.
the market. And I know that, yeah, no, it's interesting. I know exactly what you're talking about, because they're, and I don't think that people are, I don't think that investors are thinking that they are timing the market, but
Right.
I think all they know is this time right now doesn't feel comfortable. And so the urgency that they have is just don't move, just don't do anything. But that's actually, obviously going to be to their own demise, because you can't get to a certain part of the cycle, say, I don't like it, I'm out of the cycle altogether, because you're never going to grow wealth that way. You cannot grow wealth that way. So if you really want to grow wealth, you have to be willing to ride through the various portions of the cycles that we go through, and not just try to exit when you don't like the cycle anymore and think that, oh, I'll come back in later. And I'm agreeing with you 100%. The right now is the most pivotal time to move. We just closed on a deal like 2 weeks ago, and we're still moving forward, buying properties. And was the capital raise a whole lot harder?
Oh,
Absolutely.
yeah,
You
right.
know, it was nowhere near as quote easy as it was 2 years ago, right? But I agree with you that it's critical to understand that the opportunity is now. You cannot time the market, and if you're going to sit off on the sidelines right now, thinking that there's going to be a better time to move, it's going to pass people right by.
And it's shocking, right? I mean, so what happened in 2008? Right. So you're saying, okay, if I had a time machine, I'd go back to 2009 and I'd buy everything up. Okay. And you, in 2009, you had extremely high unemployment. You had almost no wage growth. You had a basically no end to the drop. Remember, the real estate market didn't bottom out until late 2012, when the crisis started in August 2008. So that's almost a 4 year time frame. So the market was continuing to drop while people like me were just buying everything in sight, right? There's this discomfort. So the first thing I want to tell you is this: the moment of greatest profit always involves discomfort. That is extremely important. So if you're buying at a time when everything is going right, that's not going to be your moment, your greatest glory. That's going to be, you might make money that way, but it's not, it's very unlikely to be your moment of greatest glory, because discomfort is actually required for success. Read all of these books, listen to the masters, and they'll tell you that discomfort is absolutely mandatory. They were all peeing in their pants when they made their greatest investments, all of them, right? In every single instance, they were terrified with what they were doing, but they were doing it because the mathematics of it was right, and they were making a non-emotional, logical decision. And how do you tell that decision with, let's say, multifamily? It's a good example, right? So 2 years ago, when you were making an investment and you were investing $100,000, you were investing into a property that was at an all-time high in terms of, you know, its valuation. So an all-time low cap rate means all-time high. And you're buying at 3.5 cap, 3.75 cap. And the assumptions that anyone purchasing anything at that point a time had to make was the economy will stay strong, rent growth will be extremely high, and will continue to stay high. Because if they didn't make those assumptions, then they basically couldn't buy that property. So you were fine with making an investment at the peak of the market at 3.5 cap with, you know, assumptions of high rent growth for a number of years and a very low cap rate on exit. Come today. Now here we are in September of 2024 or 2023, where those cap rates have dramatically changed. In fact, in the last few weeks, because of treasuries going up and the 10-year, you know, fixed rates going up into the sixes, we are now seeing deal after deal being at 5.5 cap. That's 5.5 cap is the new 3.75 cap. So today, the same deal with the same net operating income or slightly higher income, remember 2 years have passed, so the income's increased. Overall, there's been rent growth in those 2 years. So we've had very high rent growth, and then we've had slightly negative rent growth. Now we're flat. But overall, when you look at it, NOI or net operating income as a whole, looking at 1,000 properties, has increased. So something that you were willing to invest in 2 years ago is now roughly 26% cheaper, has higher net operating income, and all the assumptions that anyone is making are much more, you know, grounded, not 4% rent growth, but 2% rent growth. And everyone's making those assumptions, and they're still being able to buy because now everyone's making the grounded assumptions. So no one's offering that $3 million over purchase price that they should be, that over the reasonable price. So everyone's in a narrow band, right? And for some reason, people are like, this is the wrong time to buy when prices are down 26%, when assumptions are more reasonable, and we've clearly hit the top of the interest rate cycle, right? So I think that no one can time the interest rate cycle. There's still a prediction that we might get 1/4 point increase in November. But there are people who are betting hundreds of billions of dollars, much smarter people, much richer people. And those people are saying either we will have no hikes anymore or we'll get one last hike in November. Now, try to find any people that say that there will be more hikes in November, and you will have a very difficult search. So people who are in charge of hundreds of billions of dollars, like Vanguard or Blackstone or BlackRock, are basically betting all of their future strategy on no more hikes or 1/4 point hike. Well, either of those two mean we are at the top of a hiking cycle, and once rates go down, we don't know how fast they're going to go down, or you know, when they're going to get back to a reasonable level, but they will go down. There's a 100% chance that rates will go down. Who knows by how much, and who knows how quickly? Then you have an extremely bullish environment that you're buying into, but you're still paying a discounted price because of what happened in the last 2 years.
Yep.
And
You know, you said.
it's incredible that in this environment people are afraid of buying. I'm kind of looking at it saying, where's the brick wall that I need to bash my head against?
You know, I'm laughing because you said a lot of big
Behind
names
me.
there,
Behind me.
right? You said a lot of big names there, right? So we're talking about, you know, Vanguard and, you know, BlackRock.
BlackRock, Blackstone. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
all of them, right? And I have another big name that I'm going to throw out there. And this is my theory as to what's also causing a problem, and it's misinformation. So the big name I'm going to throw out there is Google. So right before we started this podcast interview, I hopped online and I just Googled very quickly, what are cap rates today in multifamily real estate investing? And Google spit back out that the average is 7%. And I'm like, it is not 7%. There is no way that is accurate. So because we're behind the scenes and we're looking at deals, we know what's actually happening in the market. But a regular average passive investor that's not behind the scenes, not looking at a ton of deal flow every day, gets on Google. Google's exactly what I just put. And then they get the answer that gets spit out that the average is 7%. Then
That's
they get a
true.
deal from a sponsor that's at a 5.5, cap rate. And they're
Or
like,
five and a quarter.
oh,
I
yeah.
mean,
Oh, I don't know why you're doing that. You should get one. I don't want to go anything, but that's not at least six or above, and it's like, that's not where the market is at. So this is part of the problem too, is I think that there's misinformation out there. So when Google is telling investors that the average cap rate is 7%, they're looking at our deals thinking that we're crazy and that there's way better deals out there to be had because Google doesn't know what it's talking about, frankly. It's not behind the scenes. It doesn't know. It's wrong. Point blank. I just checked it literally 30 minutes ago. So it is
absolutely.
crazy.
I think 5 to 5.5 cap, 5 cap for deals with good assumptions, because that's a sweet deal. 5.5 cap for deals without assumptions are where we are at. So let's what you hit on that was very interesting to me is this concept of a gap between buyer and seller expectations and the concept of a gap between a syndicator or a general partner and a limited partner's expectations. So there's a few things I want to tell you. When I was buying property in 2008, 2009, remember buying, my goal was to buy one property a month, and I was achieving that almost every month. Back then, I was buying properties that had been worth $250,000 in 2007, and I was buying them at $90,000 in cash. So I'm basically paying a 62, 63% discount from peak, right? Now, here's the part. It's not the 62% that I want to make a point on. Back then, when I was buying every property, I thought that the sellers were overcharging me on every single one. The buyer and seller gap never closes. It doesn't matter how distressed the market is. The buyers always feel that the seller is screwing them. I was like, I'm buying this property for $80,000. They're all worth $400,000 or $500,000 now, by the way. And I was like, no, but I should be paying 70. I should be paying 60. I don't think this property is worth 80. Right. So I actually screwed myself out of a few dozen properties back then because I was so determined, even in the middle of a 60% price decline from peak, not to overpay. Right. So the buyer-seller gap is ever present. It never goes away. It's there at peak. It's there in the middle. It's there in the trough. It's there in the middle of a depression. It's always there. And this is, if you read these books, you understand that Warren Buffett really doesn't try to buy properties exactly at value. He knows that he always has to buy a little bit above value because the buyer-seller gap has never vanished in the last 200 years. So there's always going to be some value that you have to pay above the true fair market value of a property because even in the middle of a recession, like I said, I felt like the fair market value had dropped from, 250,000 to 80, and I was still buying at 90. But those properties are all worth 400,000 or 500,000. I still own them. I never sold them. My wife likes them. So
I'm
bottom
sure she
line is,
does.
yeah, man, she's got reasons to like them, right? Bottom line is, it's extremely important to understand that your favorite syndicator will never exactly pay the value of what the market is, because the market never exactly reaches the value at any point of time. At the peak time, the market is always above the exact value. And at the bottom, towards the bottom half of the side, you're always paying a little bit more than the value. But you're still paying a heck of a lot less than the peak. That's your gain, that 26%, discount that you're receiving today for the same net operating income. That's your gain. Should it be 30? Yes. Is it ever going to be 30? Never. And that's the point, that waiting for that last 4% means you never buy. And that's why the Titans, people like Buffett, they're continuing to buy all the way along the dip because they're like, I can't time the market, but I know that, hey, I'm getting a 25% discount. That I know for sure. So I'll take a 25% discount. Then in a month, I'll take a 26, then a 27, 28. I don't know when it's going to bottom, but I do know that if I keep buying every month in the dip and I buy in a U curve, I will have bought at the bottom. I will have bought at the bottom, and I don't know when that's going to happen. I'll just buy all the way along the U curve. I'll cost average or dollar cost average along the curve. And then when the market rises at some point, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years, all of my assets will be way under, all of my assets will sell for way more than what I've paid for them. And that's the simplicity of investing. In my mind, it's much simpler to make a decision to invest today than 2 years ago. Much, much simpler to make a decision. You simply have to understand that the market forces are all in the favor of the buyer at this time, and they were all in the favor of the seller 24 months ago when you were throwing money at the wall like money was free.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting that you say that too, because I'm sure you've heard this, as I have also. People are like, you know what? I'm just going to go put my money in a money market account because, you know, they're paying out at a huge percentage right now. It's great. And I'm like, okay, but again, and you know, you're talking about the simplicity actually of investing. So I think that what's really important too is people need to think, why are they doing it in the first place? Are they, you know, if they're just simply, if their goal is something that has to do with just short-term cash flow and that's all that they're concerned about, fine, go put it in a money market account, you know, no biggie. If you're trying to grow wealth, if you're trying to create a legacy, then you're going to need these types of investments that can significantly produce large returns when you're exiting that you can turn around, do a 1031 with, and continue to grow and grow and grow. So is the goal, you know, short-term cash flow or is the goal wealth creation? And it's been interesting to me to see people lose sight of the why to begin with.
They do.
So
And so my approach to that money market question is really different from yours, right? So here's what I say to my investors. Okay. Money market is a terrible idea when discounts are available. Absolutely terrible, terrible idea. And here's why. If you look at inflation over the last 10 years in the United States, its average has been 1.5%, right? 1.5%. And during those times, you were not making any money in money markets. Maybe you were making 0.25%. Money markets have been making 0.25% during those 10 years. So inflation was at 1.5%. You were making 0.25%. Basically, the value of your money was dropping by 1.25%. Let's just call it 1% simply because it's easier to use for example. So the value of your money was dropping by 1%. All right. Today, in a money market, you make about 5%, right? That's how much you can make, 5%. But if you average out inflation over the last 12 months, it's 6%. 5 minus 6 is minus 1. You were losing minus 1 for the last 10 years, and you're losing minus 1 today, and somehow you think it's different. It cannot be different. The only reason you're making more money is because there's more inflation. And as soon as inflation comes down, that number is going to come down. Nothing has changed. You're still losing 1% of your net worth every single year. Nothing has changed. There is no benefit. The benefit is completely nonsensical. And if you don't understand that, you're not an investor, you're a speculator. You think you're actually making 5%. No, you're not. In a 6% environment, you're making 5 minus 1. Well, you've been at minus 1 for the last 10 years. There is no difference.
Now, Neil, you said it better than I could for sure, but so I'm glad to step aside and say, let me let the professional data scientist speak to that. And you know, you make a solid point. You really do. What I'm curious to know is when you're talking about being a speculator versus an investor, it kind of makes me actually think of a book that I read. I think it was called The Secret of the Millionaire Mindset, if I'm not slaughtering that. And it was really, I had quite the epiphany from it because it talked about how basically rich people play to win and poor people play not to lose. And it talked about the difference of having a growth mindset versus a limited mindset. And it really resonated with me because at the time I had, you know, I had a capital event and I had a lot of money to make a decision with, you know, or at least what I consider to be a lot amount of money. And I wanted to save it. I just wanted to save it because it felt good, you know, and that's what I wanted to do. And I recognized in myself that I was playing not to lose and I wasn't playing to win. And ever since that epiphany hit me, I've had to remind myself of that time and time again, every time I make an uncomfortable investing decision. Am I playing to win or am I playing not to lose? And I have this lecture with myself to force myself to do what is in alignment with my ultimate goals. And I'm not going to accomplish my goals if I'm scared and I'm playing not to lose. I'm just not. So that makes me think about you talking about a spectator versus an investor. So how would you define what you mean by being a spectator versus being an investor?
Sure. What is your mental state of mind? Are you so let's check do a checklist. So you hear bad news. And does that bad news make you think I am not going to make an investment? If that's the case, then you're a speculator because I think fundamentally most people understand that there's more opportunity in distress. So if you start hearing, let's say there was one cash call that you'd heard about in Q1, and now you're hearing about three cash calls. Okay. So how does that make you feel? Does that make you feel, oh my God, that's bad? No. Shouldn't it immediately make you feel, oh my God, this is good? There was one cash call in Q1, now there's three. Doesn't that mean that all of these properties are in distress? Doesn't that mean that some of these properties are going to go into the market and they'll be forced to sell even if someone's offering little money? Should I know who are the people that are buying today? Who are the people that have huge amounts of money in the bank, right? I have $64 million in the bank right now. And if you want to attach one word to me right now, to Neil Bawa, it is the word predator. Predator. Right now, I am the king of not low ball, but insulting level low ball offers. And why shouldn't I? I mean, why shouldn't I? I am bailing other people out, right? So, and it's 10 times harder to raise money right now. So the fact that I have $64 million in the bank is to my credit. So all I am is a predator right now. I see opportunity everywhere and I have to hold myself back and say, no, maybe not that one, maybe not this one. I'll wait for this one for 3 months, but this one's really awesome, right? So I'll give you an example of this and it'll blow your mind as to how, investors think, right? So you know what the biggest opportunity today is? And I love multifamily, you know that. I mean, I have a huge multifamily, portfolio. But you know what the biggest opportunity is? It's land. Land. Most investors can't really invest into land, but I think it's a good example, right? So why land? Because multifamily today, even if you buy it, it's 26% discount and it makes cash flow, right? So it still makes some money. It may not make high cash flow. It's still a much better buy than when there was better cash flow. It's fundamentally a better buy today with lower cash flow if you're understanding investing, but it's still cash flows, right? So there's something tangible there. What if you had land? You bought your land 2, 3, or 4 years ago. It was very speculative. You probably paid two or three times what it was worth. And now, guess what happens? Because you paid two or three times worth, its property taxes have gone up. Property taxes are there on land too. And now you have no income, no chance of selling it. And huge property tax bills. So guess how much land is discounted today? 60 to 70%, right? So I have a four-person team running around the United States making one land offer a week, and none of those offers involve any money because my standard offer is I will give you a $15,000 deposit. After, and then I have 6 months to decide whether I want to buy this piece of land. And then after 6 months, that $15,000 will go hard and I'll give you another $15,000. And then I have another 12 months to decide whether I actually want to buy the land because the city has to basically approve everything that I do. And if the city doesn't approve, I still get my $30,000 back. Now, do you realize just how ridiculous this is? And with a $64 million pot of money that is in my bank, I can put a ridiculous amount of land into contract, not pay anything for it, right? Can I do that in multifamily? No, I still have to go hard on day one on multifamily because it's still an asset class that makes cash even in the middle of all this distress, right? So I still have to put, $100,000, $200,000 cash in multifamilies, and I'm doing that every day. But with land, I can basically squat on millions of square feet of land for no money. No money. Right? That's distress. You see the excitement in my face? It's like I'm going to sit on millions of square feet of land, not pay anything for it for a long time. And half of this land, I'll just buy it. I'll just sell it later. The day I'll basically close on it, the next day I'll sell it. Why even build anything?
No, very, very interesting approach. And you are smart to do it. If you're looking, purely from an opportunity standpoint, you are correct. You've identified a tremendous opportunity.
Because it's
And
completely illiquid, Right? It's completely liquid. Anyone can sell their multifamily property today if they want. I mean, I just sold a property. It was a 40.5 million was the selling price, and I had 12 offers, right? And you know, the only thing that's changed for me is I probably could have gotten at peak 44 million. You know, my NOI has gone up, so it's not a huge difference. But at peak, I could have probably sold this property for 44, 45 million and probably have $500,000 hard on day one. Here I only have $100,000 hard on day one, and people are taking more time to close, and that's fine. I mean, I paid $23 million for it, so selling it for 40 million, I'm sure my investors are going to be happy. So bottom line is that multifamily is still liquid, but there are illiquid asset classes today, like land, that have advantage. Now, I'm not suggesting that any of you should basically that are listening as an investor say, "Oh, Neil Bawa said, you know, land is cheap, so I should go out and buy land." Horrible idea, by the way. Land is a very specialized area. What I'm trying to tell you is investors are thrilled by what's happening today, right? Is your mindset, what was the question that Jeanette asked, right? How do I know if I'm a speculator or not? If fear is what is driving you today, not greed, then you're not an investor. Greed is driving me right now. I'm looking to squat on as much land in as many places as I can as I can find. On the multifamily value add side, I'm slightly patient. You know, I'm doing the same thing that you're doing. I'm buying properties. Again, I'm doing the dollar cost averaging. I know I'm in the bottom of the curve, but I don't know where. And so I'm continuing to do it, but I'm also planning to accelerate into next year because I think that Q1, Q2 are likely to be the bottom, maybe Q3. And then basically it's up from there for the next 4 or 5 years. I don't know how quickly up, but up. And that's enough for me. Investors don't particularly worry about how quickly will the market go up or when will it peak next. The answer is whenever it gets to the point where I can make 2x or 3x my investors, that's what I'm going to be selling at. Until that, I won't sell. As long as the market's moving up, it's in my favor, right? Because every month, that means my cash flow will increase a little bit. I'm interested right now in talking to investors, not to speculators, because the investors understand that today, lower cash flow is in fact the sacrifice that they're making for a much lower price. There is nothing possible without sacrifice. True investing requires sacrifice. So there will never be a time when you will get high cash flow and low prices at the same time. Those two things are impossible to achieve. So, but if I had to, I would take low prices and low cash flow over any other combination.
Absolutely. You know, I remember we had a blog article that came out a while ago, and the title of it was something about patient capital, but it really is understanding, as you very well understand, this is a long-term strategy, and you've got to be patient, and you just have to be dedicated and persistent and, you know, consistent, really. So I can't say anything better than what you've already said, Neil. I am curious what your advice is for people that are having this aha epiphany moment like I did when I read that book. And all of a sudden, they're realizing that maybe they are a speculator and not being an investor. How do you advise people to shift that attitude, to shift that view, and to get out of the wrong mindset and into the right one?
As soon as you finish this podcast, walk away from your computer, go to your nearest place that you like to walk in. I do this. My backyard is very zen looking. I've spent, you know, a huge amount of time developing it to a place that's zen for me. Just simply walk away from your computer. Don't read the next email. Don't read the next blog article, and definitely don't look at that goddamn phone. Walk away because you learn something that has incredible value. Potentially for an investor that has several million to invest, you just made millions of dollars. And the worst thing that you could do is pick up that phone again, walk away, go to the nearest park, and then spend the next 10 minutes away from your phone thinking about what was said here. Because you've just heard something. It has no value when you hear it. You have to internalize. Internalization requires you to repeat what you just learned back to yourself. And that's what you need to do at this point in time. The people that are so good, people like Jeremy Grantham, people like Warren Buffett, are very good at taking concepts and ideas that they didn't invent. They heard about them from other people, but then they internalize them. And then they're very disciplined about saying, "I came up with a great idea. I understood something of great value, and I'm going to follow it." That's really the answer. It's not, I'm not saying you should pick up the phone and talk to Jeanette right now, because it doesn't, right now you don't truly believe it. Your job is to get to the point where you truly believe it and your mind starts to flip. And then you start to see excitement. I feel excited every day. I wake up and I go, I don't have to buy a property for 3.5 cap, right? I can buy one for 5.5 cap. I can build one for 7 cap. That's really great. I wasn't there a year or 2 years ago. Life has created challenges for me for the last 18 months. And in return for me having to deal with those challenges, now I'm offered opportunity.
Very, very good advice. And in the spirit of keeping things real too, and kind of sharing more about what it's like behind the scenes, in actuality, Neil, you'll totally understand this, but some of our listeners might be surprised to know this. We don't accept every investor into a deal that wants to come into a deal. This is someone we're going to be partnered with for 3 to 4 to 5 years, more than likely, or even longer, depending on, if we're 1031ing and how long the relationship goes. It could be 20 years, 30 years. And if I can tell that an investor has a tremendous amount of anxiety or fear over participating in an investment, I will actually go ahead and just remove the opportunity from the investor. Because in good conscience, I do not want someone investing in a deal that they do not feel good about. And also, I don't want to, frankly, have someone that's a nervous wreck for the next 3 to 5 years calling me every
No.
single month, wanting to talk over all of the financials every single quarter. I also don't want that. And so, again, being real and keeping it real here, I think that's something a lot of investors also don't realize is that from the sponsor standpoint, we do have to also carefully evaluate who we're partnering with. We see the partnership
Absolutely.
equally as important as investors do when they're selecting what sponsor they want to work with. It really is a two-way street. And so, I think just to add to what you said is, for investors that are listening, if you are having those feelings and you do want to get over that and you do want to address those thoughts. I thought that was excellent advice, Neil. You're right. They've got to believe it themselves and have confidence in their investment decisions, because I'm surely not going to talk them into it. And I don't think you would either.
No, just remember, there was a guy named John Paulson. He was actually Treasury Secretary of the United States for a while. And John Paulson did what is known as the greatest trade ever, the greatest trade ever, because unlike Warren Buffett, who would invest money and make profits, John actually made $15 billion without investing money. Because he simply believed that the housing bubble was about to crash and he shorted the entire market, right? He shorted credit default swaps and ended up paying nothing for them because they became worthless, by the way. And so he paid nothing and ended up with $15 billion in profit. When you're fearful, it's best to read about the masters, read John Paulson's story, watch The Big Short. This is the time to watch The Big Short. Because if you watch that movie, right, Amazing Stars, you realize that all of them were terrified while they were making the right decisions. It doesn't take your fear away. These people are not magical. They're just like you and me, but they follow the numbers and they understand that emotion is bad for investing. So watch The Big Short.
Yep, good advice. Good advice. I do love that movie and it is a good time to watch it again. All right, excellent. Well, Neil, this has been a fantastic discussion. I really appreciate your insights. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with the listeners before we wrap up?
This is your chance. This is your chance. Not to say in a cocktail party 5 years from now, I wish I could be back in 2023. This is your chance.
Excellent advice. I love it, Neil. Love it. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time and insight and coming back on the show. It's always good to see you and have you on the show. And for those of you that are listening, I hope that this resonated well with you. If you are feeling confident, I hope this actually reaffirmed the confidence that you have in continuing to move forward with your investment strategies. And if you're feeling a little nervous, I hope that this also is helpful to you in giving you some more to think about. And in the meantime, be sure to like, rate, and review the show. Leave us some comments and let us know what you think. If you're mad at Neil, let him know in the comment. If you love him, let him know. And just make sure that you guys continue to be bold, be strong, and keep moving forward.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.